Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, in the introduction to a few of the hundreds of shows that I've done over the years on American Variety, I've said something like, there are really only two big questions facing humanity. Are we alone in the universe? And is there life after death? And we certainly haven't answered either of those questions during the shows, but we've explored topics that address them in one way or another. This week's show deals with the second of those questions. Probably everyone has heard about what are called near-death experiences, abbreviated as NDE, the reports of people who nearly die, often on a hospital operating table, but revive or are revived, and then report experiences they had while clinically dead or close to it. Many of the elements of those experiences are eerily similar. My guest this week is Dr. Bruce Grayson, a professor emeritus of psychiatry and neurobehavioral sciences at the University of Virginia, who's also one of the founders of something called the International Association for Near-Death Studies, or IANS. So he's an acknowledged leader in this field, an MD who studies this phenomenon from a scientific standpoint and who leads a large network of other researchers who do as well. Welcome, Dr. Grayson.
Hi, Court. Thank you for having me on the show today.
Sure, appreciate you being on. I guess we can call you Bruce from now on?
Sure.
Good. So first, I guess we should define what is near death. Is it actually clinically dead or something very close to it or what?
Well, that depends on who you ask, Court. We certainly see near-death experiences in people who have been pronounced dead, but we also see people who merely think they're going to die. For example, people who are in a car accident and they have an NDE or a near-death experience as they're about to crash, but end up not having physiological damage. Also, people who fall off mountains often have a near-death experience without actually having their heart stop. So it includes people who are near-death in terms of thinking they're going to have a death coming up, and also people who are actually pronounced dead, whose hearts actually stop.
Is there a difference in the experiences that the first category of people have, who I would think are people who are scared to death, who think they're about to die, versus those who are actually on the edge of death?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the answer is we have not found any differences yet between people who actually have their hearts stop and those who don't.
Interesting. So I mentioned the similar experiences that people have in those situations. So what are the most common elements of those experiences?
Well, people find their thought processes very changed. They're thinking faster and clearer than ever before. They have a review of their entire lives. They have very strong emotions, usually intense feelings of peace and well-being, sometimes joy. They have what we call paranormal phenomena, like a sense of leaving the physical body and having so-called extrasensory perception, becoming aware of things outside the range of your senses. And finally, many people have what seem to be otherworldly experiences, seeming to be in some unearthly realm or dimension of being, encountering deceased loved ones, a divine entity of some type, and eventually coming to a border or point of no return beyond which they can't keep going and still come back.
Well, I think most people who are aware of this phenomenon are familiar with the concept of like the tunnel of light with, or maybe a tunnel with light at the end, and then their loved ones are at the end of that tunnel. Is that a pretty common or even nearly universal part of this experience?
It's common. I wouldn't call it universal. Actually, the tunnel and the light are separate things. About one third of people who have a near-death experience will describe going through a tunnel or something, some long, dark, enclosed space. And about twice that, about 60%, will describe some warm, loving being of light that they encounter. And it may be at the end of a tunnel, or there may be no tunnel involved at all. Just light appears to them.
So if out of those phenomena you described, which are really very different in some respects from each other, what's the most common one?
The sense of peace and well-being is probably the most common feature. At least 90% will have that. And this is in the context of being close to death, which is often very painful, very frightening, and suddenly you're overwhelmed by a feeling of overwhelming peace and well-being.
So let's say in a car crash or in warfare where somebody's, you know, shot up or hit by artillery and half blown up and are feeling excruciating pain but are almost dead, do they at the same time feel the pain and the feeling of peace and love that you just described?
Once the feeling of peace takes over, the pain is gone completely.
And that's at the point where they're really near death.
That's right. That's right. And they just get like transported away from the physical body and don't feel the body's sensations anymore.
You mentioned the, I guess you called it paranormal kind of experience of an out-of-body sense where they, I guess, float up out of their physical body and Give us some examples of that kind of thing. I mean, what happens then?
Well, it's interesting because you also see out-of-body experiences in other contexts besides near-death experiences. But we see often, I'd say probably about 40% of people who have a near-death experience will also have a sense of leaving their physical bodies. And they often see things accurately from an out-of-body perspective, things that couldn't possibly have been predicted. For example, one fellow I knew who had an open heart surgery, in the middle of the operation, he felt himself leave his body, rose up, and saw his surgeon, as he described it, flapping his arms like he was trying to fly. When he told me this, I kind of laughed. I'd never heard of that. So he placed his palms on his chest and wiggled his elbows around. I told him I thought this was maybe a hallucination because of the anesthesia. He said, no, ask my doctor about it. So I did. I asked his surgeon. And the surgeon said, yes, I do that. I've never seen anyone else do that. But I let my assistant start the procedure while I get my sterile gowns and glove on. And then I come into the operating room, and to avoid touching something not sterile, I place my hands flat against my chest and point things out to my assistants using my elbows so I don't risk touching anything.
Interesting. So I think people float up. I've read about some of these things too. People float up and see themselves in their immediate surroundings, and they see their own body lying there. But other people will actually float around, let's call it float, for lack of a better term, float around to other places nearby. I mean, if they're in a hospital, maybe they go to another part of the hospital and they see something going on there that can later be verified to have gone on there. And there's no possible way they could have seen that even before their surgery. Do you encounter that kind of?
Let me give you an example of that. One woman I know who had a cardiac arrest during a fairly routine operation floated out of the room and went down to the waiting room, where she saw her mother, who was smoking a cigarette. Now, her mother was not a smoker, and this really surprised her. And when she asked her mother about this later on, the mother said, I had a feeling something was going wrong with the operation, and I was so nervous, I borrowed a cigarette from someone thinking it might help calm me down.
Yeah. So things like that begin to be proof, because there's no other explanation for it, right?
Well, there's certainly evidence. I wouldn't say it's proof, but it's certainly a strong evidence.
You know, one question that occurs to me that might sound tongue-in-cheek, but really isn't, and is something that I think a lot of people would want to ask is, do they also see their long-deceased pets, those who see their loved ones, their deceased loved ones in that context? Do they see pets?
Actually, I get that question quite a bit, because most people are very attached to their pets.
That's right.
And we do have several examples of that. It's very common in children to have them see deceased pets because they don't have a lot of deceased adults to see. But I've also heard it from a number of adults who, in some cases, didn't even know that the pet had died. For example, one woman was in a car accident with the dog in her car with her, and she was in a coma after the accident. In her coma, she visited a deceased grandmother and saw her dog romping around in the woods outside the house. And she wanted to join the dog, but the grandmother said, no, you can't do that. You have to go back now. And she didn't know what that meant, going back. She didn't know where back was. But she later woke up a week later out of the coma. And when she told someone about this, they said, you know, your dog didn't make it through the accident. He died. So she saw him, but didn't know he was dead at the time.
You know, and I, like a lot of people who are pet owners, over the years, we've had a number of dogs that have passed away. They never live long enough, do they? And so in the veterinarian's office, when they're getting the injection, and I'll typically have the dog on my lap, and I'll be trying to soothe both myself and the dog and say, let's say, Rudy, you know, Rudy, I love you and I'll see you again. I know I'll see you again sometime. And I don't know what I'm talking about, but I just say that because it sounds comforting to me and the dog. But I think a lot of people probably say the same thing and wonder if it actually is true. So what you're saying is actually kind of reassuring to the many, many people who do probably wonder that same thing. But, you know, I think that that topic leads to the kind of metaphysical question of, do animals have an afterlife? Which it seems from what you're saying that some do. And then the question would be all animals? And then how far down the animal kingdom tree does that go? I mean, do insects have an afterlife? I mean,
that sounds
silly. That's
a great question.
But it does make you wonder that, right? So what would you say?
Where do we draw the line? People who have pets, cats and dogs, and sometimes birds, feel that they have a soul because they relate to us in such human ways. Mm-hmm. But when you get to insects, it's harder to know what's going on with them. We don't really relate to them in the same way. But where do you draw the line? I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah. And they would, if it were insects or invertebrates or amphibians, it would make the afterlife very crowded with all the billions and billions and billions of them that have died. So it's kind of a strange thing to try to speculate about, right?
For that matter, you can ask about plants as well. Do plants have an afterlife?
Yeah. I mean, it makes you wonder, you know, maybe if there's something like a soul, maybe there's some cutoff below which some animals don't have a soul. I don't know. You know, like I said, all this is metaphysical and highly speculative and begins to sound a little kooky to talk about.
Yes.
But it is something that if you follow the line of thought, you have to kind of ask those questions a little bit and wonder about it. But
right. It's hard to really do research in that because the animals don't typically, they're hard to interview.
Yeah. Yeah. Hard to even ask them, does that hurt or something?
Right.
You know, so it does occur to me too. We're talking about talking again about the tunnel with the light at the end, you know, the old fashioned expression, the pearly gates, the reference to the pearly gates when you die.
Right.
I wondered whether that might be a traditional expression of this NDE effect before people kind of defined it that way and talked about it that way, whether people had come back from near death and expressed that experience and that led to that concept. Do you think? Has that ever come up in your research?
I think it might. Most people who have a near-death experience say that there just aren't any words to describe it. Mm. And then we say, great, tell me about it. So we make them use analogies or metaphors to describe it. And they do that for us, knowing that it's not the exact thing that they saw. So when they see pearly gates, they didn't literally see pearly gates. They saw some beautiful scene that they use that word for to try to get through to us. For example, the tunnel we mentioned. Most Americans will say, I went through a tunnel. But people who live in third world countries where there aren't a lot of tunnels won't say that. They'll say, I went into a cave or I fell into a well. Mm-hmm. I interviewed someone who was a truck driver who said, I got sucked into this long tailpipe. So you use whatever metaphor comes to you.
Yeah.
And the same when they talk about this warm, loving being of light that radiates unconditional love. Most Americans will call that God, but people in other cultures that don't have a God at the head of their religion won't use that word. And in fact, most Americans will say, I'm going to call this God so you know what I'm talking about, but it wasn't the God I was taught about in church. It's much bigger than that.
Mm-hmm. Not a big guy on a throne with a long beard or something. It's an all-encompassing
sort of
feeling.
Yeah. Someone said it's more like the Force in Star Wars. It holds the universe together, keeps it running smoothly.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Dr. Bruce Grayson, who's a professor emeritus of psychiatry and neurobehavioral sciences at the University of Virginia. And we're talking about near-death experiences, something that he's long been a researcher on and a leader of an organization of other researchers around the world who study this phenomenon. Yes, we talked about what people, kind of the different, that some people have this experience as they're afraid they're about to die, and others do as they are, in fact, about to die. And the idea of people experiencing their life flashing before their eyes is another concept that we're familiar with. Does that occur? You said that people's thought processes become very clear, but that idea of your whole life, you know, in a few seconds flashing in front of you is kind of hard to envision. But is that something that a certain percentage of people experience?
Yeah, it's about one third of people who have a near-death experience will describe a life review. Hmm. And in this experience, which may take a couple of seconds in our time, they say that they reviewed their entire life, every single second of it, in minute detail.
Wow.
And they see things in the review that they weren't aware of having when they were alive. For example, one person told me that he could count the number of mosquitoes buzzing around him on a summer day 30 years ago.
Good grief.
But more remarkable is that they often say that they re-experience, not just see, but re-experience these life events from other people's perspective as well. For example, if they were unkind to someone in a past event, they experience that from their own perspective and also from the perspective of the person they were hurting. And they come back from the near-death experience then, realizing that we're all in this together. We're all, what I do to you, I do to myself. Mm. This leads them to basically the golden rule, which is part of every religion we have, do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Yes.
But for the near-death experiencers, it's not a guideline we're supposed to follow. It's a law of the universe. This is the way things work.
Well, that idea of experiencing events from the standpoint of someone else, especially someone you might have hurt, leads in a way to the concept of hell, right? So do some people report experiences that are the opposite of that feeling of overwhelming love and peace that you described? In other words, or do some people come back and say that they've experienced anything we might think of as hellish in some sense?
There are some experiences that are unpleasant. It's hard to know how many, because most people who have these experiences aren't willing to talk about them.
Yeah, right.
You know, they think, what's wrong with me that I had this kind? So most researchers have found that about 5% of near-death experiences are unpleasant, at least for part of it. And there may be, as I said, a lot more that we're not hearing about. The vast majority of those sound just like the pleasant one, but they're experienced in a very unpleasant way. For example, they say that they were thrust down a tunnel at breakneck speed and confronted by this blinding light, and they were terrified. And at some point, when they're trying to fight against this and get back into their body, at some point, they get exhausted and they just give up. And as soon as they surrender to the experience, it becomes blissful. So what seems to be unpleasant about this is the fear of losing control and trying to get back into control. And once you give up on trying to be in control, you experience the bliss. There's also a small number of near-death experiences that find themselves in this black void with nothing, no sight, no sound, nothing but their consciousness, and that's going to be eternity. And for most Americans, that is terrifying. Interestingly, I've heard from some people who were raised as Hindus who thought this was blissful, this is nirvana, nothingness. And a very small number do experience what we think of as blatant hellish imagery, fire, brimstone, demons. And I've only heard that from people who were raised in a culture that preached that. Some Roman Catholics, fundamentalists, Protestants, never from someone who wasn't raised to believe that was going to happen to them.
Yeah, I'm wondering, we can talk about that a little later too, about whether there's a possibility that some of these things are kind of, the experience itself is influenced by your culture and your education or whatever it might be. But, that's possible too. But I'm wondering, with all the different types of experiences that you've been describing, Bruce, some of them seem very different to me. Is there a continuum where one leads into the other, or are they connected in some way, do you think? Or is it like A, then B, then C?
Well, there's a general pattern, but it doesn't always follow. Often people find themselves out of their bodies first, and that's a very startling thing for most people. And they may hang around the body for a little while and watch what's going around, for example, on the operating table. But they very quickly become distracted by something totally unexpected. And it may be a tunnel, it may be the light, it may be a deceased entity. And then they leave what seems to be the environment of the body and go off into this other realm or dimension and engage in the life review and encounters with other entities and eventually come to that point of no return.
And all of that happens sometimes in the space of a few seconds.
That's right, in our time. But they almost universally said there's no sense of time in the other realm. There's no past, no present, no future. It's everything happening all at once.
It is mind-boggling to try to make sense of that. But
it is. And of course, they have to put it in a time sequence when they're talking to us so we understand what they're talking about.
Right. So for most people who've thought about this at all, NDE, I expect that the interpretation of the NDE is that there's an afterlife, okay? And whether you call it heaven or something else, and that's what the person is about to enter when they're pulled back from it one way or another. But what are some other explanations or interpretations of NDEs rather than that there's an afterlife?
Well, there are people who propose physiological changes that might explain it, changes in the brain chemistry or structure. There are people who think it's a psychological event, that things about your attitudes will affect whether you have one of these things or not. And there are people who think that it's a totally spiritual thing. It's got nothing to do with your body or your psychology, but just something that's given to you by a divine entity. And it's hard to get evidence for these phenomena because we don't know when they're going to happen. We can't do experiments to bring them about. But we have tried to study most of the physiological theories, which are the easiest to study. For example, that there's lack of oxygen to the brain, or there are chemicals being produced in the brain that are causing you to hallucinate and so forth. And each one we've been able to test has failed the test. They don't seem to explain the near-death experience. Now, I understand why people are skeptical about the cause of NDEs, and I think that's good. I'm skeptical myself. I don't know what causes them. So I think we need to consider all the different possibilities. But the fact is that NDEs occur under such a wide variety of physiological circumstances, from your heart stopping to just, you know, free falling off a mountain, where there's no consistent changes in brain chemistry or brain structure, that it's hard to tie it down to a physiological event. And sometimes it happens when the brain is totally deprived of all blood and oxygen, when the heart has stopped for a while. And in situations like that, the brain is not capable of generating thoughts and perceptions, which are, for a near-death experiencer, extremely vivid.
And I would say that one thing that contradicts the idea that it could be just physiological processes generating hallucinations or something prompted by your own cultural beliefs or your past experience is that small children have these things, right? Who've never encountered the idea of the tunnel of light or after out-of-body experience or anything like that. So wouldn't you say that that's kind of a contradictory evidence in a way against the idea that it's just a physiological process?
Yes. We hear these from young children. We hear them from people all over the world in different religions, different cultures. And if you go back to ancient Greece and Rome and Egypt, you see the same types of NDEs back then that we have today. So it does not seem to be determined by your cultural beliefs. Now, how you describe it, maybe, the metaphors you choose to use to describe the events may be colored by your cultural beliefs.
Another thing, too, is the idea we talked about earlier that people may float around an area and see things that they would otherwise have no way to see in a different room or a different space, a different place. And that couldn't be happening due to physiological processes going on in their brain as they are starved of oxygen or whatever it might be.
That's right, Court. And there are other phenomena as well. For example, there are some people who will encounter a deceased loved one in the near-death experience, someone who no one knew had died yet. Mm-hmm. Maybe they were living in another continent. No one had gotten the news yet that the person had died. And yet the patient sees that person in the near-death experience and encounters them. And it's hard to explain that in terms of brain mechanisms or psychology of wishful thinking and expectation, because you didn't know they were dead.
There was a psychiatrist named Raymond Moody who published his groundbreaking book, Life After Life, in 1975. And that book, I think, launched the modern focus on NDEs as a relatively common phenomenon that could be subject to research, and I think was the catalyst for the formation of IANS, the organization that you helped to establish along with Dr. Moody. So tell us just briefly, if you would, about that period and that process.
Yeah. Moody's book was published in 1975. In the next several years, he started getting letters from and phone calls from many researchers around the country who wanted to study this phenomenon. And Raymond at that time was in his training for psychiatry at University of Virginia, and he didn't have the time to do any of this. So he brought them all together, about two dozen of them, at the University of Virginia, and told them to start some organization to support each other. Mm-hmm. Now, he didn't particularly want to be part of it because he's not an organization person himself. But psychologist Kenneth Ring, cardiologist Michael Sabom, a sociologist John Odette, and I formed this organization called the International Association for Near-Death Studies. And we thought it would be an organization for researchers to support each other in studying this phenomenon. But it quickly became obvious that the greater need was to support the experiencers themselves, who are having trouble coming back from this NDE into a, quote, normal life. Hmm. So now the organization is still very strong. It's called IANDS, I-A-N-D-S, and the website is, in fact, www.iands.org. And they have an annual convention every year, usually on Labor Day weekend. And they have a newsletter that comes out quarterly and a scholarly journal, the only journal dedicated towards near-death experiences.
Interesting. So I noticed, as you were just describing, that a fairly large percentage of the medical doctors who research this phenomenon are psychiatrists. And I guess that would stand to reason since it's a psychological phenomenon fundamentally, really, but many others are oncologists, doctors who deal with death more directly than most specialists do and more often. So what other specialties tend to make up the members of IANS, at least more commonly?
Well, as you said, doctors who spend time with dying patients, particularly those who spend a lot of time listening to them, doctors in hospice care or palliative care. Mm-hmm. But we also hear about them from primary care physicians, those who spend more time talking with the patients and listening to the patients. Those are the ones who hear about the near-death experiences. You know, a lot of these NDEs may occur during surgery, but the surgeon doesn't have usually have the time to talk to the patient and to hear what the patient is saying. So the nurses get to hear it, but then the primary care doctor later on gets to hear it, and less so the surgeons.
Well, Bruce, we are getting toward the end of the show here, but I suspect that as the big baby boom is reaching more advanced age, more and more people are finding an interest in the question of life after death. It's kind of like the saying among World War II soldiers that there are no atheists in foxholes.
That's right.
Do you get that sense at all that interest is increasing in this phenomenon?
It is increasing. And I'm not sure whether it's due to the aging of the baby boomers or just the increased exposure in the public media. I mean, even Homer Simpson's had a near-death experience now. And that really makes people more aware of what's going on with this phenomenon. And it makes people more willing to talk about their experience. So we're hearing more and more of them.
So you've done this for decades now, since the mid-70s, gosh.
Yes.
What's your overall, I mean, just again, in 25 words or less, which is an unfair way to put this question, but how has it changed your worldview?
It's made me much more open-minded towards things. You know, as a scientist, I usually feel we have all the answers, and now I know that's not going to happen. We don't have the vocabulary to answer some of these questions. But what I've learned is that these phenomena are normal experiences that happen under abnormal circumstances. They have nothing to do with mental illness. They're not a sign of neurological or psychiatric dysfunction. They're normal things that happen that have profound effects on people's lives, and they're never the same afterwards.
Yeah, interesting. So do you find that most people who have this experience end up with a different worldview too?
They do. They're much more spiritual. They don't mean they're religious. They're not. They tend to feel more at home in any house of worship or even out in nature. But they feel much more connected to other people, to the universe, to the divine, and have a sense of meaning and purpose in everything that happens. And that makes them much more compassionate in their lives. And you see this in their altruistic behavior increasing.
Mm-hmm. So it's a good thing. Well, we are at the end of the show, Bruce. So to see videos and articles and more about this, go to the IANS website, which Bruce said is at IANDS.org. And another good website on this topic is the Near Death Experience Research Foundation at NDERF.org. NDERF.org. So those are places you can go to read more about this. And the original book we mentioned, Life After Death by Raymond Moody, is still available. Well, Bruce, thank you so much for being on with us on American Variety. It's been really interesting.
Thank you, Cort. It's been a delight talking to you.
You too. And thanks to all of you out there for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.